the Good Doctrine Podcast, where we believe that good doctrine establishes good living. I'm Sean Paslin.
And I'm Josh Howard. Episode 133 of Good Doctrine Podcast. Good to be back with you, Sean. This is quicker than the last time, as we were discussing.
Yeah, we actually only have spent 2 weeks apart since. I mean, we talk like every other day, but it's only been 2 weeks since the last podcast, so we're doing pretty great. I prefer less time away, but
yeah,
sometimes life gets the better of you, so I'm glad that it's just taken 2 weeks.
I have a suggestion. So we're on episode 133, but we've been at this now for 3 years.
Yeah, something like
that. Yeah, so here's my suggestion. 30-second episodes. We knock out about 80 of them. So little 30-second, you know, like you ask me a very quick question, like, Josh, you know, what do you think about Nephilim? And I answer within 30 seconds, boom, podcast. We could rack up, we could bump those numbers up real fast.
But yeah,
just a thought.
The trend in media is short, like short-form media. You know, I think it all started with...
Short and clickbaity.
Yeah, it all started with Vine like 40 years ago. And then now Instagram Reels and TikTok and YouTube Shorts, that's
your generation, Sean. You guys have ruined everything.
They call me old
your
now.
Generation.
And there are things now that categorize millennials that I remember like seeing on the internet when I was, you know, like 10 years ago, not even that long ago. And I remember seeing on the internet and thinking, oh, that's so cool. Like, for example, the things that they that Gen Z blasts millennials over is like home decoration, right? And millennial gray is their description of how our houses look, like how we have to have everything is like clean and simple and everything is very neutral colors. Man, I thought that was like cutting edge. You know, you go into an IKEA and everything is one color or like all white or whatever. Anyway, Gen Z hates us. And I can say I'm old now because there's the generation under me is calling me a boomer. And boomers are like 127 years old now. So...
Yeah, well, if you're old, then I'm something past that. So yeah, just old.
Well, but good. I'm glad that we got all that stupid small talk out of the way. Let's talk about something important.
Yep, we're both old. What about the Bible, Sean?
You know, it's funny. You're wearing a shirt that no one else can see. That I also have this shirt, and it is a shirt from the school that I currently attend and that you used to attend. But it's apropos for our podcast today because we are talking about. Academia, Christian academia, Christian scholasticism. Maybe we'll broaden that horizon. Christian scholasticism.
Book learning.
Yeah, book learning.
Book learning.
It's a topic that I don't think we've had a particular podcast on this. Maybe like Christian education. I know we've had a podcast on, but I think you and I we might not share. Vastly differing opinions, maybe we do, but I know that we're in definitely two different worlds. You are at the point in your life and career where you are a part of this academia, and you are teaching. You were one of my professors, technically, at one point. You are right.
Don't you ever forget it, Sean.
I don't, because I was thinking I still have that paper that I wrote for you, but or for that class. But you are writing, you're kind of like in the sphere where you're being published by these scholastic Christian groups. You are, you know, teaching on a university level. And me, I am still taking classes. And I think our experience with these two or with this subject are vastly different. And I think also our opinions on this subject are vastly different. But...
they might not be that much different, but yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. They might not be that much different, honestly. But yeah,
arguing, but I really don't mind arguing. But I have been like, without divulging too much of my personal life, I have been frustrated recently with my interactions with Christian academia. I am still in school, and I have a couple more classes till I'm finished, and will never be back in school. But yeah, so. There's a couple of statements that I have written down for myself. Some of the positives, some negatives, maybe. And maybe we could just talk through these. I don't want to be too loosey goosey on the podcast, but I do. And you know, I want to have some function, but I haven't like necessarily written notes, except for some observations that I've made about Christian academia. Now, let me preface this by saying, and maybe you can help me define this too. But what I mean by Christian academia is things like Christian seminaries, institutions that are, or at least were started to, I didn't write this down on my notes, but that's kind of another thing too. The seminaries were initially started to train pastors, at one point included the Ivy League schools. They were initially started to train
included the Ivy League schools.
Like Yale, how and they Princeton. Started. They were started to train men of God who would preach the word and to take the word, you know, to the rest of the country. You know, these American institutions. There are seminaries that still exist. I know that that's a huge talking point within the Southern Baptist Convention is. You know, who's going to get a hold of these seminaries? Are the liberals or the conservatives going to maintain control of these seminaries and who the seminary presidents are? A lot of denominations have seminaries or Bible colleges. I mean, even a lot of small associations like the one that I'm a part of has a couple of Bible colleges and a seminary. So it's a common thing. And more than likely, if you're listening to this podcast, you go to church and your pastor, I mean, probably like a 99% chance that he has been to a Bible college or a seminary. Or maybe you yourself have been to a Bible college or a seminary. So these things are ubiquitous. But what I mean by academia is the teaching in these seminaries, the things that these seminaries produce, the kind of the thinking that they produce, the journals and the that's kind of all included in the thinking that they produce, but also the milieu or the kind of group of people that make up the intelligentsia in the Christian world. And that that changes within every country. Like, I mean, in the U.S., there's a few notable – or there's lots of notable people who are involved in kind of the intellectual thought of, you know, the Christian American culture – whereas in France, you know, it's completely – I mean, I think that the Anglophone world has its people and, you know, the Francophone world has its people, and they don't really intersect a whole lot. But, so the academy or academia, you know, Christian academia is just sort of what is being taught outside of Sunday morning pulpit stuff. How do Christians get information? What are Christians talking about? What are Christians teaching? Because when you talk about academia, generally you're talking about university level stuff, and so that's kind of where we'll focus. But is there anything that you wanted to add to that, Josh?
No, I mean, like you walking through that little introduction, I thought of like, you know, 15 different things that I want to run down.
No, you don't
I'm
add
looking
anything,
at,
but
at the
15
notes.
Different things.
15 different things, but yeah, we're going to get there, and I'm jotting down a note. But let's just go ahead and let's start walking through some of your points, and we can see about that.
Okay, so. Most people in America, most conservative Bible-believing Christians in America, you know, regardless of the denomination, most conservative...
Asterisk beside each of those words, conservative asterisk, Bible-believing asterisk, all those terms need defining, but yeah.
Okay. But
just a barb, from a lot of the the recent denominational politics, not just within the SBC, but within virtually every major Christian denomination right now. Most claim to be Bible-believing, and yet what actual Bible-believing Christians are is up for debate, I think.
Yeah, I was trying to be as general as possible.
I know. I'm just being sassy, Sean. Forgive me. Go ahead.
But most red-blooded, patriotic Americans have a problem with the university system, the secular university system in the States. I know recently there was a Supreme Court decision to, at the university level, to abolish affirmative action, which is, you know, allowing people to enter the universities based merely on their ethnicity. So most people in the States, I mean – it's most conservative people in the States have a problem with the university system. Now, the things that they have a problem with in the university system is that it seems to be that they're good, homeschooled, perfect jean skirt wearing little kids will go to university and then come out of the university blue haired liberals. That seems to be kind of like the biggest problem that people have. However, my problem educationally and institutionally is more than just like you've got some people that teach that America is not great and that you should dye your hair blue. And I think that the academic institutions, the Christian academic institutions, are too similar to secular institutions in the sense that they insist on having niche dissertation topics. So this is going to be like really niche kind of talk, this podcast, but I do want to, they insist on having a unique dissertation topic, which encourages going way, way, way outside of the boundaries of, like, I want to say like average person Christianity. We can talk more about that. I have a problem with honorary doctorates, which seems to be a politicizing thing, that and Christian institutions do this too, which is bizarre. And I have a problem that secular institutions as well as Christian institutions produce tedious studies and impractical studies concerning the latest fads of things, and they seem to be changing with the winds and waves of culture rather than this is my problem with with Christian institutions. They follow the Christian culture like, or they follow culture like secular institutions do. So there's a whole lot to that. But before I go on, do you want to say anything?
Oh yeah. So first of all, you were talking about, I mean, well, honestly, like, yeah, let me look at it from two different ways. So like, number one, you brought up the fact that a lot of conservative Americans, and, you know, like, let's just put a whole bunch of asterisks in there, you know, on all these terms, right? But there's at least a large portion of America which is disenfranchised or disenchanted, let's say, disenchanted with the higher education model. So yes. for many years, at least when I was coming up, kind of the expectation was you graduate high school, and if you can get into college, you ought go to college. You know, the degree is important, but it's more important that you get there and that you get going. And then, you know, you go as high in that education as you can, and that will prepare you then for the job market, et cetera. And I think a lot of those in the West, a lot of people have realized that college has become, you know, essentially a, I don't want to say a daycare, but essentially, you know, it's kind of a holding pattern for kids that aren't ready to enter into adulthood. They're getting degrees they don't use, they're spending money they don't have, and they're wasting time that they should be investing in maybe other things. And we're also seeing a concomitant drop-off in kids into...
I didn't go to university. What's a concomitant?
My word. Is this a small word episode? Okay. We see a at the same time trend of
why
people
can't
not
you
going
just
into
say that with your book learning. Okay, go ahead.
Sean, dadgummit. So anyway, you also have a drop off in people entering into trade schools, right? So you have a lot of lack of skilled labor, a lot of you know, I don't want to start, you know, just trying to name, you know, trades or anything, but, you know, like I'm thinking like base trades, like those trades you always need. You always need plumbers, you always need welders, you always need contractors. You need these people to build the country type thing. Yeah. So, but you're seeing a huge drop off in that. So I think there has been a kind of, and I don't want to just say it's a conservative reaction, but it may be primarily a conservative reaction that, hey, we maybe shouldn't just shove our kids straight into college, but instead maybe college should be for if it's going to benefit your career or your growth, then yes, you should go to college. But if trade school is what's going to really set you up for a great future and that fits with, you know, your learning type and your personality and your wants and desires, like, then do that type of thing. So like that seems good to me. That's not super removed from seminary. So, there's a lot of reasons for this, but I think for a lot of us, seminary is just where pastors go. You know, like, and if you want to know how this looks, pull up the online job posting. You know, there's all sorts of organizations that have pastoral jobs that come open, right? That they'll post these job openings on, and most of those are going to have seminary education required,
yeah.
Right? They want you to go to seminary, so it's kind of like what the bachelor's in the secular world used to be. This is like your entrance stamp. It doesn't matter what you went for, or where you went. If you have that seminary degree, you have the sticker. You enter in. For a lot of us for a long time, that was where pastoral training was expected to go. And I think you have seen, again, a corresponding pushback within the
this is what within the seminary. Blue-haired liberals have done to you.
Okay. As we've seen in the secular sphere, that reaction back, that kind of, you know, kind of rubber band reaction back against it, I think you've seen something similar
yes.
within seminary. This is, again, agree. This is just my perspective on that. But I think you've seen a explosive growth of, hey, let's raise men up within the local church. Let's have local church training. Let's have, instead of sending them off to a seminary where they can study under one of the theological greats, which there's a lot to be said for that, right? But instead of just expecting that for everybody, let's have pastoral training where we can actually train them up. They can learn Hebrew, Greek. There's resources available to them. And we can train them without having to, you know, send them off to an actual physical seminary, as would have been the traditional model.
Yeah, and in doing that, like you said, there has been a explosion of those kind of small little Bible schools that are kind of church led or popping up everywhere, and you kind of avoid all the things that I said that were, you know, I had problems with, like the institutions, you know, these large institutions go away with that. You know, a lot of the red tape and a lot of the, well, in the States, it's totally different than everywhere else in the world. But the what do you call it? The government regulations and stuff go away too.
Right. Well, and let me touch on the government regulations. Well, let me say two things. Mm-hmm. So first of all, there's pros cons, and we might wind up talking some more about these. But there's pros cons when you have that, right? So if you have a whole lot of pastoral training popping up within the local church, which means it's probably local pastors, you know, starting these type of things up. There's going to be pros and cons with that, right? Like in some cases, that's going to be a great way to meet a need and to raise up leaders. In other cases, it's probably going to be a guy who shouldn't be teaching people or shouldn't be organizing these things, trying to lead others and making a big mess of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. That being said, like I said, we could talk more about that in a minute. But that being said, it's not for no reason, I don't think, that what we see within seminaries looks a lot like what we see within secular institutions. And that's because seminaries go through accreditation processes. So for a variety of factors and for a variety of reasons, seminaries have sought accreditation through national and sometimes secular accrediting services, which means they have to meet certain criteria, they have to have certain processes in place, and a lot of that has to do with, or maybe not a lot, at least some of that has to do with funding. Mm-hmm. To receive, for example, a government loan or a government grant or a government, you know, et cetera, to go to a higher learning education, it has to be accredited typically. To receive that money, then, a lot of seminaries have sought accreditation. That's not the only reason, right? But, like, that would be one of many factors for them to do so. But when you seek accreditation like that, you are going to start to resemble, because of the things you have to meet for accreditation, you're going to start to resemble the secular collegiate, you know, higher education.
Because you have to meet certain standards to maintain that accreditation.
Right. Yeah, you're going to have to meet certain standards, and you're also going to want some – you're going to want a seat at the table, in essence, right? Yeah. So, like, seminaries don't want to be – they don't want to put all this time and effort and money into something and then be regarded as weirdos of the fringe religious, you know, section. Yeah. They're going to want a seat at the table. They're going to want to be able to participate in scholarly debates and write for scholarly journals and be invited to scholarly conferences and have that kind of seat at the table. And to do so, once again, you're going to have a bit of interchange or mixing between the sacred kind of institutions like seminaries and those secular institutions like colleges and universities. So again, all that to say, it's not for no reason that we see a lot of the same things, same dynamics, same characterizations going on in seminary that we do in public universities and colleges.
That's a really good point. I really appreciate your ability to flesh, even though we have not talked about this yet, you can flesh out what I'm very poorly summarized at the beginning. That's really helpful. But yes, I think that is inherently what all those things that you said, like the seeking of accreditation is the word, accreditation in order to be able to provide government grants and government loans. I am a beneficiary of that because the current seminary that I attend is accredited in the whatever the accreditation organization is or whatever, and so I can receive Pell grants. So I'm able to have some of my tuition paid for. Now I will say that what ends up happening, because I've also gone to an institution that was not accredited where you couldn't get government loans and grants. You had to seek private scholarships and private grants. And there were things that were worse about that, and there were things that were better. I think the things that were better about that is it kept tuition a lot lower, because right now I pay for my religious education the same that I would pay for a secular education, because there's a whole institution built up around it because of this accreditation and because of this, you know, wanting a seat at the table. And I would argue that that's something that I disagree with about the institutions too. And I don't know, you didn't say one way or another, but just because I have like my name on paper that I'm a part of this club doesn't mean that anyone's going to listen to me. Like I've never heard of a secular journal referencing any of the professors at the school that I attend, other than to, you know, talk about the weird fringe crazies. Seat at the table. I don't know how far that goes, but one of the things that I mentioned was, and you are the only person that I know personally that has written a dissertation, and I've gotten to see how you went through that process. But this is a staple in academia that your dissertation, which is essentially a book that you come up with a thesis, an idea that you are to flesh out. You know, you're to academically flesh out, you know, interacting with sources, other experts on this topic. And the PhD level is like the level where you're finally able to say, this is what I think. And you're finally able to say, here's an idea that I have. I mean, that's another thing that I'm incredibly frustrated with is I literally am just summarizing books at this point in my academic career. And it makes me want to lose my mind. But at the PhD level, when you're doing your dissertation, you're finally able to say, this is what I think about a topic. But for some reason, there is a I don't know, and you would probably know why this is the case, but when you're choosing a dissertation, you cannot choose a dissertation that someone else has done. You may be able to have an opinion on, like you can say, this is my opinion on someone else's opinion about this, or this is an evaluation of this person's treatment of this particular topic. You know, you can kind of skirt around that, or you can have like a crazy niche dissertation topic on why sound systems in churches should have speakers that are less than 92 decibels or whatever, and that could be your dissertation topic. And I think that's a weird holdover from secular academia into religious academia, where we have a standard, we have a like a playbook that all of our religious education involves the scripture. And if we're going to use the scripture as the basis for our thinking, you know, about whatever topic it may be, if it's about the decibels of the speakers, then you should argue that from scripture in a Christian institution. It's a weird hindrance to add to someone. It's a weird, what do you call it? Handicap to give someone that they may not have the same dissertation topic as someone else. And that seems like one of those accreditation standards, or, you know, something that's kind of a holdover from secular institutions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the dissertation part, that was probably one of the weirder things that I had to kind of think through and work through. So the criteria for the especially for like a PhD dissertation, like the one I wrote that you were talking about, you have to make a I think it would be termed like an original contribution.
Right.
It has to be a original, or I don't want to say new or novel, but it has to be essentially a unique contribution. So you're not just saying what others have said and what you think about them. You're instead saying what you think, and it is contributing in a new way to an ongoing conversation. I'm adding in my voice. Well, when you're doing that, then, you know, the whole conversation comes down to like, what does new or original, what does that constitute? So if Sean wrote about how Jesus is holy, and then Josh comes along and writes about how Jesus is holy, well, it might just be the fact that I'm writing it and I put such a unique voice on it that's different than Sean's, you know, it's an original contribution. But typically that's not going to fly. They're going to say, no, Sean, you know, he speaks pretty much similarly to you. He wrote on that pretty recently. You're not going to say anything that is substantively different, so you need to find something different. Well, if you're to think about the secular world and secular topics, I'm sure one can find a whole lot of ways to contribute to ongoing conversations. When you come to religious fare, it's a very thin line between actually contributing to an ongoing conversation and talking, or versus talking about something no one cares about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of my point. So, like, I didn't want to be mean.
Right.
That's kind of my point.
No. So right now, you know, you can log on Christian Twitter and find any number of controversies within Christendom, right? So you could find a bunch of people arguing about the fact that, what was it I just said, like God is holy or something like that. So God is holy, what does that mean? And they're all arguing about it. Let's just say that's a current thing. So you could contribute to that current conversation by engaging that topic in a way that would help that ongoing conversation. That's hard to do, though, because that requires you timing those things. That requires you, and a dissertation takes years to write. And typically these arguments and things happen at a lot faster pace. So it's really hard to time some of those things. This is the thing with theology, just to kind of sum it up a little bit. You don't want to say something heretical, right? Because anything that is brand new within theology is probably going to run a high risk of being heretical. You know, if I say something that is brand new and undiscovered about Jesus, it's probably just wrong, right? Yeah. So that's one risk. But then the other risk, and this is the risk I see far more often, is like you were talking about. You know, what did a figure from history? What did Charles Finney's breakfast regimen have to do with the way his sermons were preached and the timing of his third point? Yeah. That sounds like I'm being sassy. That's probably a serious dissertation topic.
I heard someone ask about how it was Charles Spurgeon's mother or something. You know, how his mother's interaction or Bible reading time for him was yada yada yada. And
Spurgeon's a good example. Like, Spurgeon is a fascinating figure. I'm thankful for the good writings that we have on Spurgeon, but there have been, especially when you talk about like dissertations, not even the books that have been written on him, but just the dissertations that have been done on him, any nuance of Spurgeon's life, like the way he ate eggs and how that affected the way he looked at his, you know, manuscript of his sermon, like it's so specific. And you're talking about somebody, and this is the way I look at it, Sean. You've got somebody that God has called to ministry, I would hope. Somebody that's dedicated their life at least to ministerial pursuits. They're spending years of their life delving into this. There's sometimes I just wish, like, I wish some of those guys would have been invested in writing something more worthwhile for the church at large. Sometimes those, when it becomes too niche and too removed, I'm not saying you can't do specialized scholarship, but there's a point at which it just seems a bit pedantic, or a waste of time, let's say.
Well, yes. Okay, good. So it's interesting that we're on the same page, or at least a similar page.
I told you we would agree a little more than you thought, Sean.
Well, yeah, probably a little bit more than I thought.
I'll tell you this. I thoroughly enjoyed my dissertation because they allowed me to do exegetical theology. So I got to dig in, well, biblical theology, really. So they let me dig in. They let me take a theme in Scripture, trace it through Scripture, and delve in and work through biblical theology and then establish a systematic conclusion at the end of it. That's awesome. Like, that to me seems worthwhile.
Regardless of the topic, then, at the end, or regardless of the thesis at the beginning, having done that is already useful for the church, because if someone can read it and then glean from whatever the topic is, let's say it's the decibel level of the church sound system, or, you know, or the wattage of the church sound system, if you can have that, you know, if you have that conversation through the Scripture exegetically, here's how I arrived at my conclusion through the Scripture, that is at least useful for the church in some way. But if it's, you know, like, I think the worst ones to me are the character, not biographies. I think biographies are fascinating and very, very useful, but like the niche character studies, or, you know, how this person's like daily active. And that, like you said, it sounds weird, but people write on that, and it also sounds like
we're picking on the historical theology guys just a bit, because typically those type of dissertations are, you know, that's the thing. Like, so, like, for example, I'm really grateful. Augustine, let's take Augustine. So Augustine, you know, foundational figure in Christian theology. I'm really grateful that guys have dug in so thoroughly into his life that we can know as much as we can about, you know, the way his doctrine was shaped and et cetera. But that, I mean, it's almost kind of like an inevitable consequence of that sort of study, that somebody's going to wonder, how did he eat his eggs at breakfast and that sort of thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, somebody's going to write a dissertation on that. So anyway.
Yeah, well, that's fun. Okay, so forgive the neighbors in the background. I think they installed a pool. My window's open because it's very,
nice.
Very hot. But anyway, maybe you don't hear the children screaming, but...
Joyful French children frolicking in the sun.
They don't sound joyful to me. Oh, goodness. They're drowning each other. it's that... Yeah, anyway. So the second thing, we don't need this spend a long time on this, but I think that institutions can become very quickly politicized, which is something that obviously we understand that the secular world does. You know, oh, this sure. this Harvard professor said this. Well, so what? It's just some dude. But they're a Harvard professor. But so, you know, obviously, like, we can use in the Christian world, oh, well, this – I don't know. What's a seminary? Good grief. Why did I lose names to seminaries? I got a – so Midwestern. This Midwestern professor said this. So what? He's literally just a guy, and he's teaching, you know, whatever. Mm. It doesn't dictate. But
– so
go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to push back on you, Sean. You're making a point, though. Go ahead. And then I'll push back.
I know they're not just guys. I know that they are charged with, you know, educating the future, right? Is that what you're going to say? Is that the?
No, not exactly. I was going to say, like, there's a bit of a vetting process that's beneficial in higher education. So like right now, if let's say there's a professor, one of your professors at Midwestern, he publishes an article on how Charles Spurgeon ate his eggs, and he publishes it through an academic journal. Well, number one. You know that if he's a Midwestern professor, there's at least there's some sort of vetting, one would hope, at least, right? Yeah. Some sort of institutional vetting. He's not just off on his own doing his own thing. There's people over him. There's people talking into his life, keeping him in check institutionally, right? And then you also have him contributing an article to a journal. That article is going to be peer reviewed, which means they kind of crowdsource it out to a few of his peers that are subject matter experts in that area. They vet it. They send it back with edits. So like by the time he writes and says, you know, Chuck Spurgeon really liked his eggs easy, you can trust like, okay, he might be wrong. He's got the potential to be wrong, but there's at least some steps in there that make me a little bit trustful that this is at least probably coming from an established place versus literally any guy in the world can jump online and by tomorrow he can have his own YouTube channel, his own podcast, his own blog, his own, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, do it.
I mean, like, look at us, you know, we're.
Yeah, look at us, man. Nobody's vetting us on this podcast. Yeah,
you're right. I mean, you're right. You're right.
There any voice can just pop out there.
More than it's just some guy. I know.
Which is not like a rubber stamp guarantee, right? But at least gives you a little bit of hope that hopefully there's some vetting going on here.
We've seen people who were representative of certain groups, like this guy recently. We talked about that article that the guy wrote that was very racy, raunchy, and he was literally like
the infamous article.
Well, yeah, he was. He's supposed to have been vetted. That was kind of our problem, was that he was supposed to have been vetted, and yet people were saying, oh,
at multiple levels.
Yeah, I have no idea that he thought that, even though that was chapter two of his book.
That they co-signed
on. Yeah, so it's yes and, yes, but.
Sure.
But the I'll state some of my kind of things broadly by saying the politicization of Christian academia is bad. It too closely resembles how secular academia works now. We even have things like, we didn't talk about it before, but Rick Warren, who was just at the last SBC meeting, the church that he planted, Saddleback in California, was removed from the Southern Baptist Convention. Before that, Spurgeon College, not affiliated with Midwestern Theological Seminary, but other Spurgeon College, which is, speaking of Spurgeon, gave him an honorary
– The one in England.
Yeah, gave him an honorary doctorate, which is to say
– And made him chancellor, I think, didn't they?
So, which is to say you have – he didn't earn a doctorate degree like you have, which is a PhD. He didn't earn that. The idea of an honorary doctorate is that a school is recognizing that you have contributed enough to – you know, the Christian world or the academic world in whatever sense, you know, that they're going to bestow upon you an honorary doctorate as if you had done, you know, the doctoral work because you've already done essentially the amount of work or whatever. Anyway, it's just a political thing. There's a reason why these people gave it to Rick Warren. It was to make a statement about that they stood with him. It wasn't that they really believed that the purpose-driven whatever was this great contribution to humanity. It was just a political statement. And I have a big problem that Christian colleges find themselves in this position where they can do stuff like that. I think that's it's weird. And it's not good. It sends bad signals to the world.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting because there's always been debate over the, you know, good grief. What's the word? Not conferred doctorate, but, I just lost my whole train of thought here. There's the earned doctorate, yeah. And then there's the one you were just talking about, which is a...
Bestowed? Given?
Honorary. Oh. Good grief. Help me out here, Sean. The word flew out of my head. Honorary doctorate, right? So, like, there's always been debate over that. Can they call themselves doctor? Can they actually, you know, say that they hold a degree if it's not an earned degree, yeah. But it's only an honorary degree? Like, there's always been that back and forth. But it's very weird, and you and I have experienced this, like, sitting in a chapel and seeing someone be awarded an honorary degree while you're literally taking classes, writing papers at that very moment, and paying money at that institution, and they're telling you this is worthwhile, this will be worth your effort. This is not just a piece of paper, it's about what goes into the piece of paper, mm-hmm. And it means something. And then they hand away the degree that you're working, yes, toward somebody else who's done nothing for it. It's just very odd, yeah. Very, very odd.
Yeah, because we did sit in that room and watch a guy, yes, get an honorary doctorate, and I remember, yes, thinking, can't wait till I...
For reasons which were very unclear,
political. It was to align. Yeah. It was to align the institution with that individual. Right. So it's,
we're with him.
Yeah. So problem. I have the politicization of Christian academia is a big problem right now. I think that also what kind of goes in that is I think that American society is becoming more and more distrustful, is that a word? Skeptical of the establishment, you know? Like, conspiracy theories aren't really conspiracy theories anymore.
The man.
Yeah.
They're suspicious of the man.
Yeah, just anything that presents itself as an authority is very... People are very likely to not just question, but just immediately distrust anything presented as an authority. And
I think authority. I think that hits the nail on the head, by the way, that word. I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And so one thing and I want this to be known. I know that we're 36 minutes into this podcast now, so maybe it's a little too late. Maybe people have already checked out. But I want this to be known that I am not advocating for no seminaries, no Christian institutions, no Christian academia. That's not what I'm advocating for, because I think that to some extent, that's what people have done, is they say, well, like, if what they call seminary, cemetery, and a lot of people,
you'll just lose your zeal if you go there.
Yeah, there's a book that I read that's How to Stay Christian in Seminary. You know, because there's the idea that devoting yourself to intense academic study is going to rob you of joy, and I know for you that's not true. For me, it's a little closer to true, but I think it's kind of stupid to have this expectation that, well, I know I got to get learned, but I just really want to run up and down those aisles, and I really want to, you know, hoot and holler, and like, I'm not going to be able to, because they're going to tell me why that's not biblical. There's this weird idea in some Christian circles that, because you said like everyone wants a seminary education, you know, it's on the job description, but no one wants you to actually bring that book learning into the pulpit. So
don't bring that in. Yeah, okay. No. And for one thing,
okay, go ahead.
You've got a little bit of a point, yes, with the they'll rob you of your joy. So like, there was a time, you could probably make the historical argument that especially when liberalism had dominated Christian seminaries, let's say like early 1900s, that was a factor. Like, there was pastors literally going to seminary and coming back not believing the Bible, not believing, yes, in the incarnation, not believing. So like, for those who grew up and that was kind of still in their, you know, their remembrance or their, you know, their rear view mirror, I get that, right? Yeah. But I don't think we quite have that problem now. But what were you leading into, Sean, before I...
Well, I just wanted to kind of wrap it up with, well, there's two things I really feel like we need to talk about. But we have no accountability. I can do what I want. We're not accredited. I do want to talk about like Christian education in the church as opposed to the academy, you know, as opposed to like outside the church. And I do want to talk about you might have heard the expression like, oh, he's so heavenly minded, he's no earthly good, which is a stupid expression that I don't know where it came from. I don't know where it comes from. But I do believe in kind of that you can be too academically minded to be useful as a pastor. Now, I'm not splitting the dip. I'm not saying that you have to be one or the other, but I believe that you can be too much into the academic exploits of, I won't even call it ministry, just the Christian world, you know, to be useful as a pastor. And I would use John Calvin as an example, not to say that he was such a person, but we can talk about that. But Yeah, I do want to talk about. So I've kind of dumped on the institutions, and while I don't think that they're out and out all bad and that you should avoid Christian institutions, I think there's some things to be cautious of and to be to recognize that these institutions have to answer to someone. So if it's the SBC institutions and they're accredited, they're answering both to the SBC, the conference at large or the convention at large, and they're answering to kind of government entities with, you know, how they have to remain it's not just accreditation, but, you know, it's the seat at the table kind of thing, and their accreditation and their position within like state education. I'm just saying be aware of these things, and not to immediately say, well, like, okay, well, we're going to do a home church and I'm just going to read my Bible. It's just going to be me. Obviously, if you've listened to any other podcast that we've ever done, we take a very strong stance against that. But how should then Christians be educated within the church? Now, I made a point. I think that there is a benefit to Christian schools, whether they be university level or like little kid level, Christian co-ops, you know, that have like Christian education that educates about the Bible and about things. And one of the reasons why I feel like that's important is because I feel like Christians should be educated before university. They should be thinking about these things, such as apologetics, how to not just knowing Bible stories, but what they mean and how we should then live according to what the Bible says. These things should be taught outside of just Sunday morning. Most Sunday school education is woefully inadequate. It's either just following along in some, you know, really brief kind of book, which isn't bad necessarily, but it's just not enough. Or it's, you know, just Bible stories. And I think that Christians should be educated before university. And I know you probably have this experience too, being in a Bible college, but you weren't in a Bible college at a bachelor level, were you? Just master's level? In my bachelor level courses at a Christian college, there were people there who were Christians and knew nothing. Like, you have to take survey classes, so New Testament, Old Testament survey courses. And they, not only did they not know how to synthesize the information from the Bible and then communicate why this is important, what this matters to, you know, Christian life as a whole, but they didn't even know certain like very basic tenets of Christianity. And it made for slow learning, because I anticipated that when I went to a Christian institution, I would be around people who were educated Christians and wanted to further their Christian education. But most of what I was experiencing is people who had just graduated either from a private Christian high school or homeschool that did not know their Bibles as well as they could have known them. And so my case is, you don't have to wait until my encouragement is that you shouldn't wait until university to have like a really, to use your word, robust Christian education. And I think that the local church should play a really big part in Christian education. And what I mean, like, write papers, and not just like what our modern idea of, like, you know, at the bachelor level, you just read this book and then write a summary of this book and what this person said, but interacting with the text, educating Christians how to interact with the world, interact with the text, and how to defend the faith. I think it's really important. I think the local church could do a much better job outside of just Sunday morning. But what do you think about Christian education within the local church?
Yeah, I mean, the short of it is, totally agree with you. I think it's a huge need. You know, we did it at our previous church. We got the classes accredited through the seminary because that was helpful to a couple of guys. But no, I'm a huge fan of that. I think the challenge of it. The challenge of it is, number one, that, you know, you're mentioning being too heavenly minded, no earthly good. That has always been the primary complaint leveled against me in my preaching and my teaching, has been that it's too academic. And so that's been, and I've shared this on the podcast before, like, that's been one of the big struggles of my ministry, is trying to communicate in a way that's accessible to the people that are maybe the larger words they may not be familiar with, or they're just not reading in the same circles or having time to read at all, that sort of thing. Communicating at a level that is robust, to use my word. No, it's enough to feed the people that are growing more quickly, but it's also on a shelf that's low enough that people can access it even if they're not, that sort of thing. That's really hard to do within the church. Anytime you talk about, for example, higher education, writing papers, reading books, for most church people, that is so foreign to their context, their reaction is going to be, well, this guy just wants to start a seminary. He should probably just go teach in a seminary somewhere.
Yeah.
Because for most of our churches, we are so experience-based. We're so, church is an experience. You come here and you feel things and you experience and see things and you jump around and sing things. And it has nothing to do with actual content. And so the experience then of learning the deep things of God seems not only foreign to us, but oftentimes a bit offensive to us, as if, like, what is this guy trying to do that he's teaching me these deep things of God? I don't need to know about God's immutability or aseity. Those are foreign academic concepts. Those are things for the seminary, but not for the church. But then on the flip side, we wonder then, like, why is it that according to that Ligonier study that we've referenced to death at this point, but the majority of evangelicals are heretics when it comes to the person of Christ.
Yeah.
Like, they do not have an orthodox understanding of who Jesus is, much less anything more deep. So, like, when you bring all that up, Sean, like, my reaction to that is, like, absolutely, we need that within the church. And the pastors that recognize that should be prepared for their churches to shrink when they do it.
That's a good point.
That's my only conclusion. And I'm not trying to cut the Holy Spirit out of this. Like, God could make this a massive work within your church. He may grow your church through that. And indeed, we've seen churches when good, solid, robust, you know, deep teaching was brought into that church. We've seen a lot of growth. But typically, at least on the front end, at least on the short term,
yeah,
you're going to see some people react negatively to that sort of thing. And I think if we see the need, we should be okay with that reaction. You know, if my kid's arm is broken, I'm going to be okay when they said it, even if he's mad at me when they said it, because he's going to realize down the road it's better for him and it's going to grow back stronger.
Yes.
But I think that's where we're at.
I agree with the general sentiment of what you're saying. Really, I do. And I think, though, that there's a difference between big words and big concepts, and people equate big words with just too much. Like, I know I joke, but, like, when you use big words or whatever, and I know it's just part of your parlance. It's how, because you read and you're exposed to this, it's how you speak. My kids speak the way I speak, which is, like a medieval peasant, but, like, my kids speak that way because they're exposed to it, you know, and the things that they read, they're exposed to that, so it comes out. But I think that people turn their brains off when they hear a word they don't know, and so it is still the role of the educator to be understandable. And I know that you said it on the front end, you know, that's kind of been one of your, like, that's your, like, mission. You want to be, how do I communicate these important concepts in a way that the people can understand them, you know, and not just, like, leave them on the top shelf?
When it's like, you know, you and I used to talk about this, Sean. Sorry, I didn't mean to walk on you there. But, like, you and I used to talk about that with you could be preaching a sermon and it's a fantastic sermon. It's at a fourth grade level. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but, like, you've made it very simple, very plain. And then one little word slips out and somebody will just turn their brain off and be like, oh, he said aseity. I'm not listening to the rest of this because he's talking highfalutin language. It's like, sometimes, and you've used this phrase, sometimes people need to stretch their necks just a bit. So in other words, if I get up there and I say, look, guys, I want to talk to you about God's unchangingness. God's an unchanging God. He doesn't change. He doesn't adapt. He doesn't need to because he's perfect. In fact, he couldn't adapt because he is perfect. He's always perfect. That's called immutability. If I've done that and I've walked you through what the term is, and then I use the actual specific term, for somebody to hear that and be like, ah, that's highfalutin language, like, my encouragement would be, like, we can over talk people to death. Like, I can use, I've come away from many sermons and realized, like, I've kicked myself the whole way home because I realized, man, I used a couple words I didn't need to use. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't need to slip that term in there. It could have done without that. But sometimes if we're explaining the things along the way, it's good for our people to just be encouraged to grow with that. Like, we can learn some new words. We can dig in a little bit deeply if it's explained to us. So
yeah,
a little bit of both.
That's the thing, is it's the role of teaching is to explain it. So, you know, you're not a very good teacher if you leave half of your audience on, you know, not understanding what perspicacity is or perspicuity is or you know, aseity or whatever, immutability. So it's tricky, but within the church. So that's the pulpit where it's kind of like broad brushstrokes. I always say preaching is proclaiming, because in my estimation, what you do on a Sunday morning is you open your Bible and you read from the text. I think that expositional, exegetical preaching is like the only way to do it. You open your Bible, you read from the text, and you say, "Thus saith the Lord." But the scope kind of widens a bit, and you can kind of not deepen a bit, but you can kind of get into the weeds a bit when you are in a teaching mode or an education mode. So how might we do that outside of the Sunday morning service in the Christian church? Because I know Sunday school was much different than it is now when it first started. And I know that several churches, when I use the word catechism here in France, people just think Catholic church. And I think most mm-hmm. people in the States probably still think Catholic church too. But catechism classes, which are, clear opportunities for teaching the basics of the faith. But how in the Christian church, and maybe we don't need to replace the academy, we don't need to replace this university system and in order to train pastors, but how can we educate normal Christians in the Christian church outside of a Sunday morning?
Yeah. I mean, you can – so, we do it through a lot of different ways, I think, within the church currently. So, Sunday school with all of the things you could say against Sunday school maybe, things like Sunday school, things like men's and women's groups, things like home groups that meet within the homes, all of those can be intentionally tooled toward Christian education. So in other words, you have a women's group that meets. That women's group could be a gossip session where you all just, talk about frivolous matters from the week, and then you exchange some recipes and go your way. It could be a time waster, or it could be something where, hey, we're reading through this book together and we're going to watch this video teaching series. We're going to have discussion questions. That's Christian education. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways I think we can do that if we're intentional and thoughtful with what we're currently doing. Or you can go a more formalized route, like we have set up in the past, you and I have set up in the past, formalized training, whether it was for pastoral candidates, like ministerial training, or whether it was for lay people within the church. We're going to study through, that course we did at our old church where it was on biblical theology. We taught a one semester class on biblical theology. It was great. So you can do it in those formal ways through the church. The thing that occurs to me is I think we need to be doing this within the church far more, because one thing I didn't bring up earlier, but you were talking about seminary and college, or the secular education versus the kind of seminarial ministerial education, and there's a dynamic, and I think it's probably a dynamic across denominational lines, is that what you used to see was predominantly pastors. So if you went into a typical seminary classroom, you'd see mostly pastors and one or two guys that were in there for other reasons, whether it was, I want to be a counselor or I want to be a professor or whatever it was. That used to be the norm in most seminaries. Now it is completely flipped to where now seminaries are very hard pressed to find any ministerial candidates within their student body.
I would say
they can't find anyone who actually
biblical counseling is the new gen ed or is the new like liberal arts. Every Christian institution I've been in or I've seen, most of the people are enrolled that have like a biblical counseling program. Most are enrolled in that, just for reason.
And I know you and I like not that's not to knock Christian counseling, right? Like there's a good place for counseling. But it's a troubling thing that we're not finding anybody. I mean, who's going into the pastorates? So anyway, all that to say, like that to me just further speaks of the need. Then, if we're not seeing that within the academy, if the academy is not training pastors, then we need to be having training for pastors within the church.
Do you think that the local church can replace the academic system that we have in the States for training pastors?
Yeah, I don't know if that's possible or even if that would be a good thing. Honestly, like I really don't know on that one. When you talk about replacing and stuff like that, so you look around at the current seminary model. Will that persist in its current form? I don't know. I do know that there has always been a function of the church wherein it taught at a higher level, at a deeper level, let's say, at a more intentional level. It trained people at higher levels of Christian education that it has largely abdicated from in recent years. So for most of Christian history, the church in some form or fashion was intentionally training people. The seminaries aren't antithetical to that. They can be a great supplement to that or a help to that, but they can't become a replacement for that. So we can't just say, well, there's seminaries, so our church is going to stick to the good old, you know, the good old gospel. We'll just preach Jesus and nothing, you know, nothing deep. And then we'll send off anybody that wants to really get that higher education. We'll send them off to a seminary. That I don't think that's a sustainable model.
It's interesting to consider because, like, it almost seems like I don't know if it was ever, maybe in the very first founding of, like, you know, these Ivy League schools like Princeton, Yale, and Dartmouth, all these places that were instituted to train pastors. Maybe back then is when kind of the golden age of the seminary was, or the golden age of the university for Christians was. But it seems like for a long time it has not been that. But who knows what'll develop. I know that here in Europe, but France specifically, in the country of France, there are two or three seminaries, but they're not called seminaries. That's not what we call. We just call them Christian schools. And they do not provide you with a degree because they they cannot, because they're religious, they cannot be accredited. So they're a religious institution. They cannot be accredited by the government. So you do not get like an accredited degree. You just get a certificate. And so churches accept these. This is what churches expect. If you go to IBG, which is the Bible Institute of Geneva, you'll get a certificate, you know, and it's a basic Christian education, 1 or 2 years, and you'll get a certificate for that. If you go to Brussels, you'll also get a certificate. Those are good schools, conservative schools that will teach you how to pastor and how to teach the Bible, but they don't really, it's not as full-fledged as, they can't afford to be as robust as, you know, state institutions. So a lot of pastors, they have almost, it's almost changed the landscape here. They'll have entire careers before they have any sort of Bible training. They don't go to Bible school when they're in their 20s. They might go when they're in their 40s, after they've already been an elder in a church for 10 years. So it's very, very different landscape, but we'll see, you know, we'll see how things develop in the States, because it looks like theological institutions are going a weird way. But you know, let me say this. I know that we've been talking for a long time, but and this is something we might disagree on, or you might not even be able to comment on. And I just recently noticed this in France too, where the pool of Christian academics is much smaller. One, we're a smaller country. Two, there's just literally a third. No. Not even a third, probably like 0.3% of the amount of Christians here that there is in the States, and especially Christian academics, it's even smaller. So the pool of people who are interacting with each other, that's something that I consider Christian academia, is these people who are interacting with each other. You know, we saw it in the Reformation. We saw it in Martin Luther wrote books against the Pope. You know, John Calvin wrote books to the king. You know, people are writing books to each other and about each other, dissing each other. It's like diss tracks before they were diss tracks. You should read some of the stuff that Luther wrote about his opponents. It's wild. But it seems to me that in the history of Christendom, and just that is kind of the life of Christianity throughout history, people have been very direct with their opposition to certain teachers and to certain things. What I notice now in American Christendom and American academia is everything is kind of veiled. Everything is kind of very not politicized. That's not what I'm going to use. I'm not going to use that word. But no one really says, yeah, so this guy was saying this and I disagree with him, yada, yada. Or this guy's a total, Martin Luther was like, this guy's an idiot. He's a jerk. He's stupid. And he worships the devil. Let me tell you why. And some more vulgar things that he would say. But the I've noticed that people don't really interact directly anymore. They kind of interact around each other. And I'm not in this world. No one's necessarily paying me to publish Christian material in that regard. But I've noticed that there is a lot of politics around Christian academia where people are – you don't want to burn bridges because you don't want to be – you want to have a seat at that table. You want to be able to write the next book. So you don't say – this directly, you might not even attack the argument. I read one book recently. It was that book on missions that it was I forget the name of it, but the guy wrote it. It was published by Nine Marks, but he wrote it first, and then they kind of caught wind of it and decided to publish it. And he didn't change anything, so it sounded really different than what normally gets published, because in his whole book, he was interacting with other missions organizations and people who have written about missions and saying, that's wrong, this is bad, what they say has corrupted me. And it was like really a breath of fresh air. And I realized then, when I was reading that several months ago, that I haven't read theological works like that in a long time, unless you're reading like historical works, because people don't want to rock the boat. It seems like to me, they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to make, maybe the person that they're arguing with is published by the same publisher, or maybe, you know, they're in the same circles. How do you see that? And this is, we'll let this be the tail end of the conversation. But what kind of effect do you see that having on just Christian academia in general? Do you think it's a positive thing that, you know, there's more books being written or whatever, but, or do you think it's an, well, obviously that is a positive thing, but do you think it's a negative thing that there's this sort of interwoven world?
Yeah, no. Yes, it's a negative thing. I mean, yeah, to me, it's a clearly negative thing. And you see it a lot. So, like, on the one hand, I would say, like, you do see some people interacting with others. Sometimes that's not done well, which is unfortunate, right? Like, there's still some Martin Luther types that are like, you know,
this guy's an idiot.
Anyway, lambasting people and just kind of vitriolic toward others. So that's unfortunate. From a lot of what I see, there seems to be far more, the vast majority, I think, is people tiptoeing around others. And I don't know their motivations, right? Like, I don't know why somebody would tiptoe. Like, for example, if there's a professor who comes out and just says terrible things about Christianity to the point where they sound like they're not even
Christian,
possibly even Christian. And yet you still see people who are writers platforming this author and soliciting this author's commendations for their books and saying, oh, what a neat thing this author said. I don't know the motivations of those people, but it makes me very, very upset, very, very wary of that whole situation. It's not good, right? Yeah. Like, and I don't know if they're doing it to get ahead. I don't know if they're doing it because they lack discernment and truly don't see the danger there. I don't know what it is. But there's a lot of that, to the point where I suspect a lot of it is just self-beneficial or self-promotive motivations.
Yeah.
People are trying to get ahead. They're trying to get along to get ahead. And that's not good within Christendom. That doesn't mean we want to be schismatics, right? Like, Sean comes out and says, I like blue shirts on Sunday, and I'm just lambasting him. That's not good, of course. We don't want to just be schismatic for no reason, but it does mean when there's people out there that are questioning some of the essentials of the faith, and we're just like, you know, high-fiving with them, and it seems like it's only because of publishing deals, that's troublesome.
It's a problem, you know, at least the way I see it, is a problem for the average person too, because they're not exposed, or they're not reading clear condemnations of certain teachings or clear condemnations of certain people's teachings. Because one thing that really, I try to be pristinely crystal clear when I speak, and, you know, this is where you should look, this is where you should not look, stay away from, and that the scriptural precedent that said that you should stay away from these wolves. And I think that if we are in a Christian bookstore, if we're on Amazon and it says number one bestseller, and even if it's a good book that says, well, some have said this, number two Christian bestseller might be the dude who said that. So it doesn't really give me anywhere to go. I might not even recognize, you know, if the author was not clear enough because he was trying to save, you know, face or save his publishing deal or whatever. It's just kind of, that's so niche, I know. But it really does affect the average person because you're not exposed to the conversation that's being had behind closed doors. And I think that you should be. It's not like, it is like secular academia. Except for secular academia is a little bit more, you know, it is okay to go against the person, you know, and have ad hominem attacks. But, calling certain people dumb or whatever, which is not a good thing, but at least it's still kind of people are willing to call other people out. But in the Christian world, it seems like the world is so small. The world of Christian educators is so small that people are too concerned with their platform, and it's like a fine line, because if you're removed from your platform and you're not able to publish another book, and you really think that what you have to say is helpful and good for the church, you know, where do you go from there? So, whatever. Yeah. It's a weird place, but Christians all across the world are dependent on Christian education. Even if you are not directly, if you're not going to a seminary, if you're not going to a Christian college, you never have, you never will, you are dependent on Christian education because the person preaching to you has been educated or not educated by a Christian institution. And so what your pastor is reading, where they were educated, the people that they're talking to, you know, that they're interacting with, even on the internet, it's important because it affects what they're teaching you. So it's something to think about. I have been disillusioned with just academia in general since I was forced to go to middle school. But
you've always yes. You've had a chip.
I've never liked school in any country that I've lived in, and I've always had an issue with it. But now, not now that I'm a Christian, but since I've been a Christian, the issue has, I think, been compounded because we want to educate and we want to communicate the most important thing in the world, which is what God has said to us, how we can be saved and how we should live. And right. And all these things that I've brought up, you know, impact that in one way or another. So if you are a Christian listening to this, which hour and 5 minutes, you better be, or else, I mean, you are in for some torture. Yeah, if you're a Christian listening to this, I would encourage you to ask your pastor to find out from your church leaders where they were educated, what you know, how they are educated now, because when they stand in the pulpit and they teach you, it's not just unless it's a certain kind of church, it's not just them and their Bible. They have gotten information from somewhere. If they've ever quoted, right. If they've ever quoted a commentary, if they've ever said, this guy said this about this topic, then they have been educated somehow, or they are being educated somehow. So it's important to know where and how and what that looks like. Also, I would pester your pastors about Christian education in the local church, how you can be a part of that, how you can become more educated that way. Might even be scholarship opportunities for local Christian schools, or like what we did, which was a satellite class. It was even free, so there are wonderful opportunities for those,
which I will never do again. $50 buy-in,
yeah,
put some skin in the game. But yeah,
hey, I stuck with it. I wrote the paper. I still have the A on my whatever it's called. But anyway,
I was an easy teacher. I was easy on your grades.
Oh, that's good. Everyone listening to this knows that I didn't deserve. I got an honorary A from the
an honorary.
Anyway,
it's not an earned A. It's an honorary. Yeah.
Is there anything good stuff? Anything else?
I don't think so. I think that should about cover it. So yeah, just as always though, thoughts. Complaints, you know, yeah, thoughts, questions, maybe follow up, shoot us an email, gooddoctrinepodcast@gmail.com. We might do this has always been one that's kind of on our minds. And I know for us in our particular context, we're right now wrestling with Christian education in every sphere. So we're looking at, you know, all the way middle, K through 12 education, all the way up to seminarial education, and how we can be a small part of that in our little neck of the woods. So this is a good conversation for churches to have, I think.
Okay, good. Well, if there's nothing else, Josh, you have to say the thing.
All right. Well, we hope you will join us next time, whenever that next time may be. And in the meantime, we pray that your good doctrine will continue to establish good living.